It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, plenty to cover, starting with local and a incident that happened this... Did it happen this last week in the Metro Tunnel? When
no,
did it actually happen?
It actually happened January 28th. What brought it into the news cycle was that King 5 got a hold of some videotape of the actual incident. It was the beating of a 15-year-old girl who was attacked by another teenager in the Metro bus tunnel.
And vicariously watching two women fight is, you know, a guaranteed ratings getter.
Yeah, and well, it was kind of shocking footage too that this girl was beaten in the presence of three Metro Transit security guards, and none of them intervened. I mean, they didn't even do the basic sort of thing that you learn in nonviolence training, which is you get between the victim and the assailant, and you try to stop, just try to be a presence to stop the assailant from attacking the other person.
And distract them. Yeah.
Yeah, and distract him, talk to him, whatever. They didn't even do that. I mean, they just stood around and watched. And it was very clear from the video that these guys had no training. They were being paid to just stand around pretty much and watch. What was also interesting, too, is that it came out this week after a bunch of back and forth between the media and the King County Executive Dow Constantine and some folks at Metro in the county, that back before 2005, the way the tunnel used to be policed was King County had stationed some King County Sheriff's deputies in the tunnel stations. But in 2005, the county decided, well, let's save some money, and they went into a contract with this private security company, Olympic Security Services, and they hired a bunch of these private contractors to police the tunnel. However,
AKA the warm bodies.
Yeah. However, the contract specifies that those folks be unarmed, that they not carry any kind of self-defense equipment with them or anything, and that they not intervene in any kind of assault or any kind of criminal activity.
And let's be clear as to the reason for that. The reason is that the county didn't want the liability of
yes.
having these people actually, you know, do something and having it turn out badly. That would cost too much money.
Yeah. And another interesting aspect of this, too, is that since this whole thing has blown up, Dow Constantine has said, well, we're going to change that policy back to what it was before 2005. We're going to station at least one King County Sheriff's deputy at each tunnel station, which is what they did before 2005. And I just want to say, you know, what was the county thinking? Okay. I mean, you especially recently when they opened the tunnel stations and they're open late into the night, you're not going to station anybody down there who can intervene in a dangerous situation like that. That makes no sense. In addition, I want to say Sound Transit also employs private security guards, but they employ security guards who belong to a union and who have decent equipment and who have the training to intervene when there's a criminal activity going on and when someone is being assaulted. So it's clear to me that this was something that was part of the county budget cuts, and that they decided, well, let's just cut corners here and there, and that includes the safety of passengers on Metro Transit.
So where do the Sound Transit security people?
The Sound Transit stations for the light rail, the other stations, not in the tunnel.
The tunnel is
King County.
Okay.
Takes care of that. Sound Transit takes care of the other stations on the Sound Transit light rail line.
And one of the ironies of the way this whole thing that has played out is that the same conservatives who were, you know, yelling last decade about wasteful government spending and the need to privatize and whatnot are now yelling about well, in addition to where were these kids' parents, they're also yelling about the compromises to public security and public safety and such. And it's like, you know, one of the real disconnects in our political discourse is the vast vacuum between what people want government to do and people's willingness to actually pay for the government to do those services. If you want trained personnel in a place like the bus tunnel, you have to pay them and you have to train and equip them. And there's simply no way around it. And many government services rise at a higher cost than the cost of inflation because they're professional services, and you can't skip on them the way by doing efficiency or by outsourcing the work. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, just putting untrained people in an area with the uniform on does not mean that they're going to be able to do the job.
Moving on, not entirely unexpected, the gun ban for Seattle parks was overturned this week.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. King County Superior Court Judge Catherine Schaefer threw out the Greg Nichols imposed ban on guns in city parks, stating that the city cannot preempt state law. This shouldn't have been a surprise because State Attorney General Rob McKenna told the city this before Greg Nichols actually imposed the ban, and Nichols and the city went ahead and did it anyway, and current Mayor Mike McGinn not only defended the gun ban, but actually went after Joe Malahan on the campaign trail. Remember when I was talking during the campaign about McGinn's tendency to demagogue? This is one of the issues he was demagoguing on, essentially accusing Malahan of wanting kids to have guns in the parks. And you know, and it's simply a no-brainer that number one, the state does not allow cities to preempt state law on this, and number two, that the Constitution, like it or not, you know, the way courts have consistently ruled from federal courts all the way down is that people have the rights to carry guns in public places. You can license those, you can restrict those, but you can't ban them. And that's been the law all the way along, and it shouldn't have been any surprise in this case. The one silver lining to this was that there was a law firm that offered their services to defend the ban pro bono, so it wound up not costing taxpayers any money for this to have to go to court. But it was Greg Nichols' ego, and then people in the city once it was set in motion, being unable to walk away from it.
All right, moving on to developments in the Washington State Legislature.
Yeah, this week the State Senate passed a bill to suspend I-960. That was the initiative that would prohibit the state from raising taxes without, was it a two-thirds majority?
Yeah, that's correct.
Without a two-thirds majority vote. They had to do that in order to pass another tax increase, which they did just moments later. They passed a 1% sales tax increase. Now, folks here in Seattle know that we already pay a sales tax. It's almost 10%. And that adding a 1% to that, plus efforts by King County politicians to add an additional 0.3% to the sales tax to pay for the criminal justice system, is going to make the sales tax rate just skyrocket.
One of the highest in the country.
Yeah, and it's no shock and it's no surprise that sales tax is probably the most regressive tax that we have. It lands very heavily on the poor, who must buy necessities and pay the sales tax on everything they buy, and it rests very lightly on the wealthy, who cannot in anyone's imagination spend all of their income in a year on anything that the sales tax would be able to take a bite out of.
Yeah, but you don't have to pay sales tax when you buy lobbyists, when you buy legislators.
That's right. Also, the wealthy have the option to go elsewhere to buy their, to make their purchases too, whereas the poor have to stay fairly close to home. Now, the notion behind supporting the 1% sales tax, one of the reasons why it passed, there's a group of progressive organizations that supported the 1% increase in the sales tax. Their whole rationale was that it could be offset for the poor by the working families tax rebate that passed the legislature last year. Unfortunately, that rebate has never been funded. You in order to give a rebate to the poor, you have to have some money go into it, and that program was never funded by the legislature, and boy, it's sure looking like this year it's not going to get funded either.
Yeah, and you know, as we've said on this program many times, Washington State is one of the most regressive tax structures in the country. We had, as I mentioned, I believe last week, a new initiative out there that talks about a high earner's income tax. That wouldn't make a dent in the shortfall, which actually the projected budget shortfall was increased $2.8 billion this week. You know, it's another $200 million between friends.
All right.
And the The 1% sales tax actually wouldn't make that much of a dent either. It would only cover about a third, or about $1 billion of that $2.8 billion difference. And so they're trying to nickel and dime other revenue increases also. An actual increase in candy. You know, they want to charge, an extra few cents to children for their spending pockets for their Baby Roots and Snicker bars. But at the same time, you know, some massive things are simply not on the table. Talking about an income tax, not on the table. Talking about, closing any of the numerous corporate loopholes and tax credits for wealthy corporations in this state, particularly Microsoft and Boeing, but also all the other companies and industries that got in under the same kind of deal because they pointed
high tech and biotech industries.
Yeah, but once Microsoft and Boeing had their deals, all these other industries went to the legislature and said, "Hey, how come we can't get that too?" And so by and large, they have. And also apple growers and, you know, I mean, you can just go down the list of almost anything having to do with the economy.
Yeah, and the legislature looks at it every budget session, you know, can we cut some of these loopholes? And they never do anything. And partly the reason that they never do anything is because they never hear from people like you and me, and they never get any pressure to do anything.
Whereas they do hear from the paid lobbyists for these different industries.
That's very true.
So, you know, it really is the case once again. And, you know, we're gonna get more of a taxpayer backlash on this. Iman's got another initiative coming up this year, and you can bet he's gonna make hay out of the suspension of 960. And we saw this week, with the passage of two school levies, with over 70% of the vote here in Seattle, and of the ones in King and Snohomish counties, 20 out of the 23 passed, and two of the three that didn't, it was because they needed 60%, and they got well over 50%. You know, when people are asked to fund services that they know they need, such as public education, they are often willing to step up to the plate. The legislature should be making the case of this is why we need more people to shoulder more of the load. Instead, they're taking the easy way out and asking the poor to pay for things they can't afford.
Yeah, and what they really should be doing is saying, look, here, we're going to institute a state income tax, and we're going to give you sales tax relief. That's what they should be doing.
Moving on to national and the giant blanket of snow that seems to have covered the entire eastern part of the U.S.
Yes, well, when somebody is being blatantly dishonest, it tends to be referred to as a snow job. And we saw the reason why this week. Mainstream media has been running with this story that, you know, many people now believe that because the eastern seaboard got massive snowfall, that this somehow proves that global warming, a.k.a. climate change, does not exist. I weep for how stupid this country is sometimes. I just do. It's, you know, first of all, as many of our listeners are probably aware, climate change models posit more severe weather events of all kinds. That includes more blizzards, more cold weather snaps. It doesn't disprove that climate change is happening. In fact, it's evidence of it, if any anecdotal issue can be evidence of it. And meantime, you can have, at the same time, on a global level, you know, the big news wasn't the snow on the eastern seaboard, although it did certainly interfere with the global markets. The big news that everybody is watching is Vancouver, BC, with the Olympics, where they're having trouble with snow because it was the warmest January on record. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for every anecdote, there's another anecdote that that reinforces that we're having extreme weather. And, you know, where does this come from? Well, it's a pretty reasonable supposition when these keep adding up year after year after year, and we keep having the highest surface temperatures in recorded history year after year after year. Yeah, it shouldn't be open to debate. The fact that the climate scientists are unanimous on this and have been now for a couple of decades, it shouldn't be open to debate. But it is dominating our political discourse, and it is dominating our media coverage because of media's tendency to want to do a he said kind of story all the time, even when one of the sides, quote unquote, of the story is just, you know, well, he says the tooth fairy exists. He says it doesn't. Well, let's have a debate.
All right, moving on to Republicans withdrawing some of their holds on
One of the many tactics for obstruction that the Republicans in Congress, and in this case particularly the Senate, have been engaging in over the last year has been blocking a number of Obama's high-level political appointees, both court appointees and appointees within the executive branch. Some 63 of them had been held up through the beginning of 2010. And going into the recess over President's Day, Obama threatening to use recess appointments, which is something that George Bush did very commonly. In Bush's case, it was very often because the minority Democrats felt that the people were ideologically unsuitable. In the case of the Republicans, it's been part of a larger tactic of obstruction and trying to prevent the Obama administration from getting anything through Congress. It's also been a pattern whereby, for a number of these holds, individual senators and one senator can put a hold on an entire nomination and
that's
do it anonymously.
That's a rule that should be changed.
Yeah, even if the committee has already passed it out and there's bipartisan support for the nominee. In many of these cases, the individual senators were doing so not out of any concern for the nominee, him or herself, but because they wanted to use it as leverage for getting pork barrel spending done in their own states. Well, Obama went into the recess threatening to use recess appointments, and lo and behold, as soon as Obama threatens to be tough, 27 of the 63 holds were withdrawn by the Republicans this week. And it tells you just about everything you need to know about how Obama and the Obama and the Democrats have been conducting themselves over this past year. That Obama's response to this was that he says he reserves the right to continue to use the holds on the remaining the recess appointments on the remaining block nominees. Well, of course he reserves the right. It's in the Constitution. You know, if this were an assertive chief executive and an assertive party, they would simply go ahead and do the recess appointees. But the Democrats, they don't really operate that way.
All right. Moving on. WellPoint. What is WellPoint?
WellPoint is one of the largest health insurance providers in the country and one of the most profitable. And this week they were getting a lot of flack all the way up to and including Kathleen Sebelius, the cabinet secretary who oversees such things, because one of their subsidiaries, Anthem Blue Cross in California, announced 35 to 39% rate hikes for California, for the millions of people in California who are WellPoint customers. Another state, Connecticut, increases of well over 30% as well. And now, why is this particularly noticeable when WellPoint it's certainly higher than other health insurance rate increases around the country this year, but not a whole lot, frankly. But the difference is that WellPoint, well, there's a couple differences. One is that WellPoint made $2.7 billion in profits, not in 2009, but in the fourth quarter of 2009. And they did so despite spending $9.5 million to lobby against healthcare reform. In other words, $9.5 million in to stop healthcare reform, and then as soon as healthcare reform appears all but dead in Congress, $2.7 billion in profits and 39% hike increases. That's in one quarter alone, a 200-to-1. Return on investment.
And how did they justify those hike?
They justified it by saying they needed to cover costs, of course, so as to continue to provide the finest quality services to their account holders.
Their customers.
Yeah. So people in California and around the country are pretty worked up about this, and if ever there was evidence that not only is healthcare reform necessary, but the healthcare reform that has been on the table, which has no real cost controls over rate increases by healthcare companies, is not adequate. And of course, what we really need is for the health insurance industry itself to not be in private hands, for that private industry to be abolished. But that obviously politically is not going to be happening anytime soon. And that $9.5 million with a $2.7 billion return is one reason why.
All right. Well, another reason why would be Big Pharma.
Yeah.
With that this week.
PHIRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, is the big trade association of the different drug companies. what's literally known as Big Pharma. And we've talked about the head of Pharma before, a guy named Billy Tauzin, a former Republican legislator who was the lead legislative point person in the House of Representatives who ushered through the Medicare Part D plan under the Bush administration in 2003, which is a huge, huge gift to the drug companies. No cost controls, no savings by the purchase by the federal government on drug care costs, and the huge donut hole that seniors and the disabled had to pay out of pocket for. Well, he then turned around literally the following week and took a $2 million a year job as the head of the trade association Pharma, which tells you all you need to know about corruption in Congress. Tauzin was forced out as the head of Pharma this week, and the reason why was something else we've talked about on this program, the deal that he cut last summer with the Obama administration, for which the Obama administration took a lot of heat last summer, essentially selling out to Pharma and offering to go soft on the drug companies in healthcare reform in exchange for them not opposing
the bill.
The various bills that the Democrats were being put forward. Well, as it turns out, they didn't need to oppose it because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Republican Party and a number of other people did a fine job of that. But this week, Tauzin was forced out as the head of Pharma because the drug companies have been, and the board of Pharma has been critical of him for selling out to the Obama administration for too little. That he should have gotten more concessions out of them. He should have opposed healthcare reform, and he didn't. And therefore, the representatives of the drug care companies now want to go in a different direction. So once again, we're seeing that this may have been the only and last for a while window for any kind of meaningful health care reform, and we're seeing yet another manifestation of that with Tauzin losing his job this week.
All right. Moving on to international and developments in Iran.
Yeah, on Monday, Iran told the UN that it would begin enriching uranium to 20% purity for use in a medical reactor in Tehran. The uranium needs to be enriched to 20% for reactor use, but it needs to be enriched to 90% purity for a bomb. But what alarmed people here is that when you enrich to 20%, you're about 90% of the way to getting to bomb grade material, because it gets easier and easier to purify uranium the longer you do it. That alarmed people. But what was interesting, too, is that the amounts that they started enriching are so small that nobody can envision them being able to make a fuel rod for a reactor anytime soon, much less the uranium for a bomb core. But if we really look at why did Iran take this step, why did they announce this now, it becomes really clear that it's a response to the internal turmoil, particularly since they made the announcement just before the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
For which massive demonstrations were planned.
And those demonstrations, even though this week's demonstrations were not as large as ones in the past, those demonstrations are triggering some dissent within the ranks of the government of Iran itself. And so there's some internal turmoil as well that could eventually lead to the downfall of the Iranian government. So they're very interested in taking these maneuvers that show that they're really, you know, in a position of strength. And that's what this was. It was one of those.
And not just a position of strength, but also appealing to nationalism, because the nuclear program has huge domestic support across the ideological spectrum within Iran itself.
Yes. And what was the response here at home? Well, Obama proposed a fourth round of sanctions against the government, and particularly against government-owned industries. Well, but, you know, you have to look at that and say, when have sanctions ever really worked in changing the mind of a government when it's determined to do something like this? What's also interesting, too, is that nobody really believes that those sanctions will go ahead without support from Russia and China. Russia's kind of waffling. They may eventually support sanctions, but China, no. That will never happen. They are definitely not on board. Iran is a major trading partner with them, and China has billions of dollars of investments in Iran in their oil and gas sector, and they really are not interested in slapping sanctions on one of their major trading partners.
Yeah, which is something that Iran knows, by the way.
Yeah, but something that the Obama administration doesn't.
All right, Iraq?
Yeah, Iraq was in chaos this week because I think we've talked about this in prior shows too, that a commission with a kind of iffy legal standing announced that 500 candidates in the upcoming elections would not be allowed to run because they had Ba'athist ties to Saddam Hussein's former party. So, but an appeals court said that they would hear some of the cases of people who wanted to appeal that ruling, and but they initially said that they wouldn't be able to decide all of the cases until long after the elections were already over, which set up the weird situation of here are these candidates that would run in the elections, maybe win their seats, and then after losing their appeals court case, they'd have to be kicked out of office and a new election run. Well, this past week, the appeals court judges said that they would try to hear all of the appeals by the end of this week. Well, what happened was that they were swamped and they couldn't get to them all. Of course, they only heard about 24 cases and they only allowed about 22 candidates to run in the elections, the rest still being banned. So this has just been an absolute nightmare for not just for the Iraqi government, but for the individuals trying to run campaigns and figure out who not only can they run, but the other candidates trying to figure out who are they really campaigning against, or do they really have any opposition. But what I want to emphasize here is that, again, that the commission that banned these candidates doesn't have a firm legal standing under the current Iraqi government. Is run by Ahmed Shalabi. Folks may remember his name. He's one of the returning Shiite exiles that the Bush administration put back into power when it overthrew Saddam Hussein. And he and another man who set up the commission, Ali Lami, will both benefit by banning the Sunni candidates who were banned by the commission. So it's very clear conflict of interest there. I think there's two possible very bad outcomes from this. One is that the elections go forward in March, but the banned politicians sue and have the election results overturned. Another bad outcome is that they're not allowed to run, and hence we start up the insurgency gets a big boost from that, and it starts a civil war.
All right, that takes us on to Afghanistan.
Yeah, very briefly, a major new military offensive being announced yesterday and today by the Obama administration in a town called Marja in eastern Afghanistan. The challenge, once again, as always, is not clearing out the Taliban from any particular place, but making sure that they stay out. And, it really is all about symbolism at this point, because they can maybe do that with one particular place, like this particular small city in eastern Afghanistan, but they can't do it over wide swaths of territory, because we don't live there. The Taliban and the Afghan insurgents do.
Yeah.
And, until we start investing not in military, seize and hold maneuvers, but in economic measures that can provide jobs and dry up the people who are now fighting for the Taliban because it's the only job available, we're going to be continuing to pour money down the military rat hole of this war in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and many of those...
It's nothing new.
Many of those folks are fighting for the Taliban because they don't want foreign troops on their soil anymore. They're tired of constant raids from NATO forces, U.S. forces, British forces, whatever. They want the invader out, and that's going to continue literally forever as long as we're there. So it really is futile.
All right. Events.
Yeah, a couple things coming up this week. Today, from 1:30 to 3:30, for folks down in the South Sound or want to head down there, there is a demonstration at the gates of Fort Lewis supporting resisting GIs, particularly Private Bishop, who is being held incommunicado in the brig in Fort Lewis. That will be at the north entrance to Fort Lewis, exit 122 off I-5, between 1:30 and 3:30 this afternoon. And then we've been talking about for the last few weeks Eat the State being in the middle of its winter fund drive and needing to make a determination as to whether we'll continue our print publication or not. We've had fabulous response to our pleas, especially the last couple weeks, but we do need to decide whether this is sustainable long term and whether to continue with the print publication, how that will tie in with the coming launch of a new redesigned and upgraded website, etc. And so we're having a special business meeting for that, to which we want to invite anybody who cares about the future of Eat the State and wants to see us either save the print publication, move into the 21st century, or both. That'll be this coming Thursday night the 18th, 7 o'clock at the state offices. That's the University Christian Church, 4759 15th Avenue Northeast. It's the right on the corner of 15th and 50th Northeast in the U District, 7 o'clock. Please come and join us. And if you have feedback on that, please let us know if you can't make it to that meeting. Email us at info@eatthestate.org. And if you want to pick up copies of the paper, we didn't print a print publication this last issue. The current one is available online at www.eatthestate.org. Or you can find old ones where you find free publications at bookstores and cafes, King County Library System, so forth. Again, www.eatthestate.org. Also where you go to donate, because we still do need a little bit of money left to make our goals for the winter fund drive. And then 7 o'clock Thursday night to decide what to do in the future moving forward.